Thank you all for being here today, representing places across the region. We have Hope Knight, President and CEO of Greater Jamaica Development Corporation. We have Melissa Mark Favorito, Senior Advisor for the Latin Victory Fund and former New York City Council Speaker. We have Laura Curran, County Executive for Nassau County, Long Island. We have Mayor David Martin, Mayor of Stamford, Connecticut. And we have Lynn Haig, City of Bridgeport's Planning Director. So thank you all for being here today. I'm going to spend a few minutes providing some context to frame the panel discussion with respect to the fourth plan, which you've heard about infinitely today, and then I'll go ahead right away and turn it over to these folks. So the fourth plan, as you've heard, includes more than 60 policy recommendations aimed to help our region grapple with some very big issues: increasing economic opportunity, addressing displacement, improving mobility, adapting to climate change. But what does the plan look like in cities and neighborhoods? How can it help places achieve their visions for the future? What does it really mean on the ground today? So this panel will explore that, what the plan looks like in cities and neighborhoods, and how we go forward as a region and individually in our own communities. In the fourth plan, we identify flagship places to demonstrate the transformative impact that the plan's policies could have in important places in our region, places like Jamaica, Queens, the Inner Long Island Sound, the Nassau Hub on Long Island, Stamford and Bridgeport in Connecticut. I'm going to take you through a few images that show what this transformation could look like before turning the mic over to our panelists, who will share their reactions to the ideas and talk about the opportunities and challenges that they see. In Jamaica, Queens, we see a thriving regional downtown with affordable housing, multicultural neighborhoods, and robust local economy linked to JFK Airport. The Inner Long Island Sound transformed from one of New York City's worst polluted areas into a healthy place to live and work. The Nassau Hub, a model transit accessible suburb with affordable housing, good schools, and a strong sense of community. Stamford, a dynamic regional job center, a model for mixed use, mixed income neighborhoods. And Bridgeport, flourishing as a new center of a green economy in Connecticut with jobs of the future and healthy, affordable neighborhoods. Now I'll turn the mic over to Hope Knight. We'll talk about what you're all doing every day in the region and what you think about these ideas and what are the challenges, what are the opportunities, how do we get there, and how do we work together? Thank you, Hope.
Great. Thank you, Melissa. It's great to be here and share this panel with so many wonderful leaders from around the region. I am Hope Knight from the Greater Jamaica Development Corporation, and the New York Times described the community that I represent here today as being on the edge of urban decay. And so you'll see this picture, this image of the downtown with large swaths of vacant land. This next slide shows you the same vantage point from a geographic perspective with significant investment committed from federal, state, and city resources to create the jump start of what was to become a revitalization that is happening now in Jamaica, Queens. There's been tremendous investment in our multimodal transportation hub. We have the AirTrain to JFK and many modes of transportation that converge in the downtown. There is tremendous mixed income housing that is being developed consistent with the fourth plan. And we have an emerging hospitality hub giving the proximity of JFK to the downtown. There are approximately 2,000 hotel rooms in the pipeline that will be coming online in the next several years. We're also involved in creative placemaking. There is a church that was in disrepair that the Greater Jamaica revitalized with the Department of Cultural Affairs in New York City. And it is now a place to conduct performing arts. We also have a major transportation node, Parsons Boulevard, that we are working with the Department of Transportation of New York to create a vibrant open space. So RPA envisions that Jamaica will be a vibrant, multicultural community with affordable housing. And we agree with the recommendations of the fourth plan and look forward to working to implement many of those measures. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to my friend, Melissa Mark Viverito, to talk about the inner Long Island Sound.
Thank you so much, Hope, and good afternoon to everybody. I'm going to try to be succinct. There's been so much that has been shared in such a short period of time in terms of the lunch program, but similar to Secretary Clinton, when I started really looking more clearly at the plan, I was very excited because from a prior legislator and policymaker perspective, the idea of issues that I really cared about, right, as a representative of a community, as a representative of the city of New York, of really looking at planning from the ground up, really looking at when you think about the vibrancy of some of these neighborhoods and areas, you know, how do we shape it, looking through the lens of what you consider the priority values, right, in terms of RPA, about equity, when you look at health, when you look at prosperity and sustainability, that everything from a planning perspective really needs to be seen through that lens. How do we create places where long-term residents still have the ability to remain? How do you create a space and a location where that has been historically disenfranchised, disinvested, that is polluted, that is environmentally unsafe? How do you create it into a vibrant, healthier community that really is there for the long-term residents that have lived there and those that are to come, and the sustainability issue? So from a planning perspective, we have to look at changing the way that we've done planning in the city of New York. And the opportunity with the inner sound, and RPA reached out to me because as part of the conversation in the city of New York when I was speaker, is that we led the conversation and I took a lot of leadership in the conversation about closing Rikers Island down. So in closing Rikers Island, creating more neighborhood-based facilities, so that what do we do, right, with the land that is now available in terms of Rikers Island? When we talk about Randall's Island, which is also in that part, when you talk about the access to the waterways, how do you create a community, right, that is thriving and that fulfills all of these values, where people can stay because we're creating affordable options, where we're creating job opportunities, where we're creating a healthier environment? So the idea of participatory engagement, of the engagement of people in the community in terms of planning the long-term vision, is something that I have always held strong to, and that the city has to change the way it approaches planning. So I just wanted to share very quickly that the perspective that I think, and I agree completely with a lot of the recommendations, and it's a really well thought out plan about the inner sound and what could happen potentially here, and being proactive and developing a planning process that is truly inclusive, where the voices of those who live in the communities are part of the visioning, that is not just left up to real estate, it's not just left up to certain interests, define what a community looks like, not looking at the new name for the neighborhood. The Bronx is a hot real estate market and everybody wants to rename it and rebrand it. No, you know, there are residents that live there, that continue to live there, that are struggling to make ends meet, that need affordable options. But that kind of perspective needs to be brought into the conversation. So when I was, my district represented East Harlem and the South Bronx and the portion of the Inner Sound, and I think is looking at the Bronx part. I represented certain parts of that district, the Bronx Hub. Randall's Island is in my district. We talked about the Rikers Island and the closure, that I took a lot of leadership in that conversation. And as part of an independent commission that was convened that recommended the closing of Rikers Island, part of the recommendations was, okay, well, let's re-envision what we do with this land, right? LaGuardia Airport could be extended, or you could create it as an educational facility and so many other options. But in East Harlem, when we went through a rezoning that the mayor proposed, I decided to be very proactive with my community and decided to do creating a new process for re-envisioning what land use should look like. And so we created a process that we call the East Harlem Neighborhood Plan, where we engaged the community thoroughly in a year and a half process that was facilitated by outside facilitators, where we did community visioning process, where we engaged in conversations with the community about what would you want to see happen if there were to be a rezoning, if we were to increase density in this community, what would you need as a community in order to feel comfortable with that happening? Conversation about affordable housing came up, conversation about healthier communities, investing in our public education infrastructure, expanding public access, all of that came up. So instead of the community coming, the mayor and the administration coming to us as a community to say, this is what the rezoning is going to look like, I went through this process for a year and a half with my community and came to the city instead and said, if you're going to do a rezoning, then this is what I need the rezoning to respond to, because the community has defined what, in fact, their priorities are, and those are the voices that I want to represent and that I want to respect. So they came up with, it was about a 150-page plan that had a whole host of recommendations in many different areas. We talked about the arts and culture, affordable housing, education, transportation, looking at public housing, since my district has by far the most public housing in the city and in the country. So that was important in terms of bolstering. So the idea of creating a planning process that is truly responsive to the voices of the community and try to turn it upside down, I think is something that really is embraced by the plan. I think in all aspects, they talk about priorities being community and process, a community-based planning process, which is something that I've always championed. And I think that that's the way we need to look at planning moving forward. So I, again, truly, and these are some of the priority objectives, just in terms of what we did at the local level and taking it into a bigger global level. The idea of utilizing the Inner Sound opportunity, since we're really on the cutting edge of starting those conversations, and having the time to have all of these voices around the table. There's a lot of thinking that's happening around different pieces in the Bronx of development and what it should look like. Trying to create a more holistic, comprehensive vision that we create a process by which all of those voices are respected and we can come forward with a plan that then informs how the city is going to approach this, as opposed to trying to force a vision down the throats of a community, which a lot of times is very, very resentful and obviously cynical about what, in fact, are the interests and the concerns of the city, usually not ones that are defined or that are in tune with the needs of the community. So I'll leave it there, but I really appreciate RPA's plan because, again, it embraces this participatory governance model. It talks about really having the voices of the community at the table and respecting the views and the process by which the community defines their priorities. That is the way we should be looking at planning in the city of New York, and that has to be something that we embrace. So I know there'll be some questions afterwards, and I guess I will. We keep passing it down, but
yes, you can turn it over to Laura. She'll talk about
remote.
Yes.
Pass the torch. Thank you very much. And I just have to say, I agree so much with you, Melissa, about community engagement. When you want to make meaningful change, you have to get the community involved and engaged, get their input, get their buy-in. Otherwise, you will not be successful. And I think that goes for Long Island, perhaps more than anywhere else I can imagine, because as county executive in Nassau, I am not the benevolent despot. I cannot tell the zoning municipalities. We have 64 villages, 3 towns, which are really like mini counties, and 2 cities, one on the top, one at the bottom, that do their own zoning. So I can come up with the most beautiful plan, but I can't make them do it. I've got to get the buy-in from the elected officials and from the communities as well. So let's see if I can figure out how to do this. Mm-hmm. All right. I think that our vision in Nassau aligns really beautifully with the RPA in terms of downtown development, which frankly we need, transit-oriented development, more ranges of affordable housing. There was just a really interesting survey done. And you know, sometimes Long Island is seen as the land of no, but I do believe that's changing. According to this survey, I just want to make sure I get the numbers correct here. So 60% of Long Islanders say it's too hard for them to pay their rent or their mortgage on any given month. That's not the normal stereotype of Long Island. 68% believe that we should legalize private apartments and private homes. That is normally hasn't been the case, and many of our zoning municipalities still do not allow that. And 57%, if you're from Long Island, this is a big deal, 57% believe that we should increase height limits of our buildings so that we can have more mixed income housing. So the times are changing on Long Island. There's still a lot of NIMBYism out there, but there are some reasons for hope. Downtown redevelopment, transportation improvements, and access to green space. So when we come to downtown development, there's a spectrum. We can build on what we've already done. Mineola, for instance, which is right in the heart of the county, which is where the county seat is, actually. There is a real thriving mixed use. Now, it's not so much affordable housing, but it is different kinds of housing that looks like that. That's not usual for Long Island. that sort, those sorts of apartments are going like hotcakes. As soon as they're built, there's a huge demand, and there's more coming. Farmingdale, which you see down in the bottom there, exactly the same thing. Right by the train station, apartments selling like, renting like hotcakes. The downtown of Farmingdale, Main Street, had been maybe a third to half of the storefronts were empty, now completely full. Great economic development. Westbury is sort of on the move. You know, we have to thank the governor. He's invested with his downtown revitalization initiative $10 million in Westbury, also in Hicksville, to get going on their visioning for what their downtown can be to live up to its potential. Hempstead is tough right now. There's some wonderful plans, but, you know, it's a work in progress. Transportation improvements. So you may have heard about the third track. Basically, it is literally putting a third track on our main line so we can do reverse commuting, so people can go into the city and out to the burbs at the same time. What a concept. And also, it's called the main line, and the stops along that line, including Hicksville and Mineola, which I talked about before, are right on that main line. So that investment will be huge for the developments in those downtowns. You've heard about the East Side Access. I know it's over budget. It's ahead of the schedule, et cetera. But it's coming eventually, which will be wonderful for our commuters and wonderful for our real estate market, because it's, frankly, much nicer to come into Grand Central necessarily than it is into Penn Station. And, of course, station improvements. When it comes to buses, this is something that is a real priority for me. We have a lot of people, about 100,000 people, who ride the bus every day. But we need to get more flexible in how we run our buses. It's a privatized system called Nice Bus, and they're very interested in adapting. So they're rolling out a pilot program in the coming weeks to have app-based, appointment-based buses to allow more flexible routes. There are some bus routes where the people are jammed in like sardines, and there's others where, you know, you could spread out and have a nap. So using different sizes of buses to accommodate those different kinds of routes. Also, perhaps looking at the number of bus stops. Do we need a bus stop every tenth of a mile to make the commute, you know, three times as long as it needs to be? No. So we're really looking at that, and I'm excited about what we're going to find. My goal is to have more choice riders, not to have people who ride the bus because they have to ride the bus, but because they want to ride the bus. I was actually just talking to someone who is a choice rider of Nice Bus today, and he's never seen The Sopranos, so he's watching The Sopranos on his commute, and it's great. Now, green space. You may think of suburbia as, you know, especially Nassau County, as built out with not a lot of green space. Not the case at all. One thing that I'm especially excited about is there's a motor parkway. I believe it was the grandson or the great-grandson of Cornelius Vanderbilt, William Vanderbilt, built a private roadway all through Nassau. It actually goes into Queens and into Suffolk as well, so that he could race his private cars. Must have been nice. So you can see the orange is where the proposed part is. The red is where it's already there. We want to connect the whole thing. There's already 3 miles of it that's been done. You can see that guy up top. So that people can use it for health, for recreation, but also for commuting. And if you've been on Long Island roads, you know, and any way to get people off the roads is great. So I'm very, very excited about this. and this is one more. After Superstorm Sandy, the federal government, through federal money, went through the state. It's called Living with the Bay, about $125 million, if I'm not mistaken. So to open up this whole Mill River that runs from Hempstead down into the water, down to the South Shore. So it's a greenway network to connect this whole corridor, make it more accessible, open it up so people can actually use it. And a thing that's very exciting about it is it also includes job training, working with students at Hempstead High School, which is an underserved school. And also, you know, job training for resiliency careers or for education as well. And it's a very exciting thing. If there's anything else about this, to make it more accessible. Oh, the other thing that's so important about this, we talk so much about resiliency. It's not just physical resiliency against storms, it's also economic resiliency. When a community has economic resilience, it can withstand so much, and that's a real goal of this. I feel that I have run out of my time, so we can talk about the hub and Belmont in the question and answer period. Thank you very much.
So, David, you're on.
We'll turn it over
to
you.
Am I on?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm David Martin. I'm the mayor of Stamford, Connecticut. And so a little bit about Stamford, because a lot of people don't know much about Stamford, including those of us who live in Stamford. It's about 130,000 people. It is the fastest growing city in Connecticut. And just before we get carried away, you know, look at that Stamford growth, that's 5% over about 5 years. That's only 1% a year. That's less than the population growth rate of the United States. But just so you know, it's called explosive growth in Stamford. Explosive growth, 1% a year. We are, in fact, I think we are actually growing a little bit faster than that, but it's the issue that Stamford is a successful community, and the resistance to change from the people that have lived there a long time as a successful community is severe. And they are constantly fighting back, and in fact, I think sometimes this idea that you shouldn't waste a crisis is in fact an issue. We need crises, we need failure before we're ready to embrace the need, the change that we need to do. In any event, we have a median household income of about 81,000, four Fortune 500 companies, nine Fortune 1000 companies. We have one of the lowest median ages in the state of Connecticut. No, we're not as low as the town that houses where the University of Connecticut is, but we've had a downward trend in the last few years because we are attracting millennials into Stamford. And we are an extremely diverse community. In fact, we are the most diverse community in the state of Connecticut, and I argue quite strongly we are the most successful diverse community in the country. Economically or socioeconomically diverse, religiously diverse, racially, ethnically diverse, the land itself is diverse, and we're not that far away. Where you can get from Grand Central to Stamford in only 47 minutes, and I know that's one of the fortunes of the success of New York is their close proximity to Stamford. Fundamentally, and at a level that I don't talk about very often, as a community has to decide what it is going to be. And one of the things you can decide is that you're going to be a tourist destination. That's not going to work for Stamford. If you land at LaGuardia or JFK, you pick up those brochures, you won't see a whole lot of things headquartered in Stamford, Connecticut. You can decide to be a retirement community. And that's fine. However, if your community has a lot of unfunded liabilities, you know, hidden debt, it doesn't work. You have to somehow grow the income and the population in order to help deal with those unfunded liabilities. And let me tell you, I'm knocking myself out trying to deal with the debts that we have inherited and cut them off from the future. But if you think that you can sit there and just be a retirement community with those overhang of debts, it is ultimately bankruptcy. So that's out. And so you're kind of left with, well, we need to be a job center. And in a job center, there's a couple of choices within that. And I can tell you in the Northeast Corridor, and particularly down here in the New York metro area, or I should say the Stamford metro area, we're not going to be a low-cost job center. That's crazy. Now, when I talk about jobs, just so you know, how many people watch the Olympics? Everybody, I bet. How many people ever watch the Yes Network? I bet you almost everybody here. All of the electrons that came from Korea came through Stamford on the way to your home. And at least, I think, a third or a half of the shows that you thought were coming from Korea were coming from studios in Stamford. The Yes Network is produced, the pregame and postgame shows are produced in Stamford. And that's just a small component of what we have in Stamford to give you a sense of what's going on in our community. But what do businesses want in a location? Well, they want proximity. Sometimes they want proximity to markets, but often they want proximity to the movers and shakers that are important to their business in some way. And they want proximity to workforce. And it is mostly about workforce. Workforce, workforce, workforce. If you don't have the workforce in an area where you're locating a business, and unless you were locating primarily for markets, then you've got to have your head examined. Mobility, of course, but mobility is related to workforce. Can I get my workforce to and from my business? And of course, is it a safe city and are there low taxes? From a safety standpoint, just so that you're aware, Stamford is the safest city over 100,000 in New England. And I believe if you extend that to New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, I think there's only one other city over 100,000 that has our safety record. But I also note that I put low taxes as last. Now, I've bought a car. Most people in here have bought a car. Do you know when I bought my last car? I decided the car I was going to buy before I walked in the showroom. Or I looked around a little bit, but when it became time to negotiate, it was all about the price. And I view it the same way with the business community. When they get down to making that final decision, the redevelopment officer is, of course, going to have to deliver some sort of deal. But they've already picked the places that they're negotiating with. It is the last thing they consider. It's the one that we talk about the most. What sort of deal are you giving to bring jobs to the community? But if you don't have an attractive place in the first place, then you're not going to be able to negotiate any of those deals. And so what I believe comes from a story that I tell you about. And I don't know which country this was in. It might have been in Brazil. It might have been in the United States somewhere. But there were thousands of acres that were cut by a lumber company for the precious hardwoods that had grown there over the decades. And they were required to replant these thousands of acres. And so they went and replanted thousands of acres with that hardwood that they had harvested. But some forestry expert got a hold of them and said, why don't you just over here in a couple of hundred acres, which was like, you know, 5 or 10% of the total, plant these weed trees. Just plant these weed trees that really don't have any commercial value. And they agreed. 10 years later, the hardwoods were well established and growing where they'd planted the weed trees. The hardwoods were not doing very well where they'd planted them all to themselves. The key is to provide the right environment. Those weed trees grew up quickly and provided the right shade for the hardwoods to establish and grow. And I believe the same thing is true when we think about how do we do economic development. We have to provide the right environment for those businesses. And if you go back to my list, well, I can't change proximity very easily, but workforce and mobility, and I am a safe community, and that's something that we take great pride and work on, but I can work on workforce and mobility. And so it's really, do I create a place where people want to be, people that businesses want to be? If people want to live in Stamford, then the businesses will come. Mm-hmm. We are trying to attract millennials, and no, you know, I understand. Even my own daughter is here on Manhattan's west side commuting to another location in order to do work, and she likes the excitement of New York. But that's our goal, is to bring the millennials here, and we are growing that millennial population. We are the only place in Connecticut that is doing that. And I won't go into how that's happening, but we are reaching the critical mass where the millennials are beginning to see this is a place that's attractive to live. And they're beginning to see that Lower Fairfield County is an attractive place to have a family, maybe in Stamford, maybe one in the surrounding communities. And that's what we're doing. And with that, because I talk to the businesses, I make trips to them, and we talk about just a very few things every time. It's what's happening with our state, which I'm not going to bore you with today. Mm-hmm. Where are they going to get their workforce? And what's the transportation network looking like? And so we talk a lot about transportation. And the reality is that in Stamford, the danger isn't a student in school. The danger isn't homicides anywhere, because we had zero homicides in the last 18 months. You get hurt in Stamford crossing the street. We had three pedestrians killed in crashes in the last year. We are trying to establish uniform signage at traffic lights. We're resynchronizing the traffic lights that was more than 20 years out of date. It comes down to an infrastructure issue. Our traffic system was completely out of date, and we had done nothing about it, no investments in it, and it was, with a growing community, a real problem. And one that we were hearing every day. And half the time it was, I can't get through traffic. And the other half of the time, it's too dangerous, we've got to slow the cars down. A constant battle going on with no real management. And I would say in the bigger picture, those unfunded liabilities that we were sitting with, the size of the benefits that had been awarded to various unions, which are astronomical, when you fully load it in, we're paying 90 cents of benefits for every dollar we pay of actually work being done. And you just can't be an affordable government when you're doing that. And so we're trying to battle those issues constantly. But what happens is everything else is getting squeezed out. So we're not providing the services. We're not investing in the infrastructure. Our roads aren't paved because we're paying benefits to a small group of people. We are enhancing bike usage by starting bike lanes wherever we can. We're doing road repaving, installing racks at the Stanford train station, and obviously, you know, just plopping bike lanes down on our busy streets is dangerous. We know that this is the trend, and we are trying to do it, but it's hard. And because we know that the future is coming, we're working with the state now to set up an autonomous vehicle pilot. And you say I only have 1 minute?
1 to 15 minutes? 1 to 3.
And when it comes to that mobility and the transportation, the single most important transportation center in the state of Connecticut is the Stamford Transportation Center, the railroad station. It is it's the busiest. I wouldn't say it's the largest. It's the busiest train station between Boston and New York City. It is a net inbound station. More people come into Stamford and get off to go to work than get on the train to go to work elsewhere. And it's fortunate so that the millennials in New York City have a place to go during the day so they can come to Stamford and work on NBC and Yes Networks. We are trying to work with the state to coordinate the development around the train station because, quite frankly, it's another place where we haven't invested in. The garage is out of date and inadequate. In fact, major sections are closed and we have no plans for the train station into the future. And that's where I'm trying to get the state, because the state is in control of all the roads right around the train station and all the garages. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to get some motion on. And unfortunately, if you've been listening to the state of Connecticut in the news, you know that we're having enormous challenges in Hartford with their unfunded liabilities, their debt burden, and the lack of money in the transportation, and it's impacting Stamford and, in fact, the rest of the state. And, in fact, I'm looking to create a TIF district around here to establish my own ability to finance the improvements that are needed in the train station, which will be a very difficult challenge because I'm not going to hand the money over to the state without some control and authority to change the direction of our train station. So it turns out we're the economic engine of Connecticut. Connecticut has balkanized its whole state. We don't have counties of any consequence. So it's every town for himself or herself. But Stamford is a net economic generator of funds to the state. And what they leave out is that, in fact, many of the jobs in the surrounding communities, Greenwich, Darien, New Canaan, Wilton, Westport, even Norwalk, Ridgefield, they come to Stamford and earn their living in Stamford. The true net generation from Stamford is enormous. We are seeing population growth while the state is losing population, and these are just some of the business. We have consumer goods and products like Hinkle and Vineyard Vines. I'm not wearing my Vineyard Vines tie today, but I'm sure somebody here is. Science and technology like Gartner and Indeed.com, and all those ads for Indeed. Their big regional offices in Stamford, and finance with Synchrony. I'll guarantee you that many of you are carrying credit cards that are run by Synchrony, and Stamford is the world's largest headquarter for reinsurance. We are trying to attract more companies, but we need to create a place where people want to live, work, and play. And that is, of course, hard in a state that's financially challenged and in a community that is carrying $3 billion, $3/4 billion of unfunded liabilities on a relatively small community. So we are investing in the region, we're investing or looking for investment by the state and the region to be a successful, continue to have a control vote. And I'll just say one other thing. I recognize that global warming and the sea level rise will be enormously dreadful to the city of Stamford. It may flood out our water pollution control plant at some point. We're talking about millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of impact. And we are working, beginning to work on a plan to try to start addressing that. Stay tuned. I think you'll hear about some of the stuff Stanford is doing to try to address the issues that we're going to see in a decade to three or four decades from now. And I know I went too long, Sarah.
And that's Stanford.
Lynn from Bridgeport.
Hello, I'm Lynn Haig, Director of Planning.
The largest city.
That's my speech.
Oh, okay.
The city of Bridgeport. We are, Bridgeport, the most populous city in the state of Connecticut at 145,000 people, sitting in a compact 16 square miles on Long Island Sound. Nicknamed the Park City, we have 1,300 acres of public space within 45 parks, including Pleasure Beach, which is reachable only by a water taxi, and two Olmsted design parks, Beardsley Park, which you see here, and the jewel of our system, Seaside Park. And unlike what my friend Mayor Martin says, Bridgeport is the more diverse, with 72 languages spoken in our public schools.
I've looked at the data.
Yes, so have I. So, RPA has several recommendations for Bridgeport that position the city to be a driver in the Connecticut economy. The first is to upgrade infrastructure to high standards of resilience. Bridgeport is a recipient of over $50 million from Rebuild by Design in the National Disaster Resilience Competition. This effort is focused in the south end of Bridgeport, which all that green space is Olmsted Park, Seaside Park. That entire neighborhood is completely within the flood zone. It includes the University of Bridgeport, several historic districts, and a power generating plant. Improvements include greener streets and new park areas to slow runoff, and a berm that will support raised streets and additional infrastructure. Near to the south end, resiliency area, is our ecotechnology park. This cluster sprouted organically in an industrial area and currently includes a 15 megawatt fuel cell, a former landfill converted to a 2.2 megawatt solar farm, a permeable pavement manufacturer, a microgrid for several city buildings, a proposed thermal heating loop, and a host of other green industries. We're making great strides to achieve this RPA recommendation and will continue to build upon what we already have in motion. Another recommendation is to protect low-income residents from displacement and homelessness. Bridgeport has a weak housing market. Our market rate is considered affordable housing elsewhere, so we get a lot of the runoff from our neighbor, Stanford. While this may help with affordability, it does provide challenges to attracting private capital, and it requires a lot of subsidy. We aren't running into gentrification problems, though, because housing is being developed in repurposed commercial and industrial buildings or in new construction such as this. But we know this atmosphere won't last because transformative projects like the Steel Point project shown here on our harbor, proposing upwards of 1,500 units, will change our market in the not too distant future. To achieve this RPA recommendation, we need to put controls in place now so opportunities to maintain affordable rents aren't missed. The challenge we face is in implementing the most appropriate mechanisms. We very much believe in the fourth plan recommendations that we partner with anchor institutions and that regional job centers such as Bridgeport are restored. So we're working with both of our higher education anchor institutions, Sacred Heart University, which is technically located in the neighboring town of Fairfield, but it's literally on the border, and it can't grow on its current campus, so it's growing into Bridgeport. And we also have the University of Bridgeport. We're working with them to modernize our zoning code to encourage their growth while addressing neighborhood concerns. We also have two regional hospitals, Yale Bridgeport Hospital and St. Vincent's Medical Center. We've recently become meeting with them. I liken these outreach efforts to courting. Right now, we're in that awkward first date stage. Mm-hmm. We really don't know what to talk about, and we could certainly use some guidance from our PI on how to successfully progress that relationship. Our talks with the anchor institutions include their growth as regional job centers. For example, we have a 22-acre brownfield shown in the center here where a lot of your green area is that we've targeted for a new train station and high-density development. With the corresponding TOD plan emphasizes jobs over housing because it's in close proximity to Yale Bridgeport Hospital, and we're looking for a lot of synergies with the medical field. The challenge here is in having folks recognize that we don't have to settle for the first or flashiest development proposal that comes along. The fourth regional plan articulated a vision for Bridgeport and laid out a roadmap that some might think is aggressive. I see the fourth regional plan as a challenge that we have no option but to pursue. We can't wait, and we need to be bold today so we can be great tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you all. I am going to ask a couple of questions, and I also want to leave some time at the end to ask, to have the audience ask a few questions. So the theme of this year's assembly is big ideas that can't wait. And RPA has put forth a number of big ideas for each of our communities. Can we talk a little bit about how we get started and how some of the projects in your community relate to RPA's vision of 2040? And I'll start with you, Melissa.
I think, I mean, in the case of the, considering the South Bronx being one of the areas that has very, very low air quality because of the congestion, also the number of sewage treatment plants, it's an area where the issue of, and I think they highlight that in terms of the analysis and the recommendations, about building a healthier community, right? So that means, one, expanding access to green space. The community has been fighting for many, many years about creating a waterfront access plan, right? Envisioning the waterfront access to Randall's Island. We actually, that's one of the projects that I was able to get done as a council member, is creating a pedestrian and a bike path from the South Bronx that goes directly to Randall's Island, where now you have access to all those acres of parkland. But the issue of creating a continuous waterfront access and expanding the amount of open green space, and obviously more fairness and equity in the planning of how trash and sewage is treated in the city of New York, that it not be overburdened in particular communities as a way of creating more equity. So the lens by which RPA is really presenting its recommendations, the idea of equity is central to all of this. And we all know how challenging and difficult that is in communities that resist change. I think if you look at the conversation about congestion pricing in the city of New York, you see some of that. When you talk about the conversation happening right now about desegregating our public schools, it is extremely contentious and controversial when it shouldn't be, right? We have a responsibility to create more equity, and government has a responsibility to do and look at planning through that lens of creating communities where everyone can thrive and that everyone has equal access. So I think for the idea of the inner sound, the issue of healthy community is central, and that really speaks and is at the heart of equity when you look at a community like the South Bronx in particular, because it has not fared as a healthy community because of decisions that have been made in the past. And so we got to right those wrongs, so to speak. I'll leave it there.
Thanks.
So I think I'm competing with you for the millennials. And maybe right now you're winning, but I think we're going to change that. Because
I welcome the competition.
Okay, good, good, good. Because frankly, if we don't keep our young people and attract more young people, I'm concerned that we will wither, continue, you know, that if you can't find a house or an apartment that you can afford, if you can't get around easily, then the businesses are going to go elsewhere. They're going to go to places like Stamford. So we have to work really hard in the county level to make that happen. So because I don't control the zoning, I'm not in charge of that. It's the towns and the villages in Nassau County. And by the way, we have 1.36 million people who live in Nassau, so it's the size of a small state. There are 11 states that are smaller than us population-wise. Something that we're developing is called the Great Places Program, where municipalities or communities, whether they're waterfront communities, whether they're by transit hubs, or, you know, maybe there's some sort of historic significance to them,
that they can nominate themselves to be part of this, and then we will work with them to help them achieve their goals. And without their buy-in, we can't impose it from the top. It has to come from the grassroots for it to work. So that's a way that we're trying to sort of meet people where they are.
So what's that expression that sometimes you forget that your mission was to drain the swamp when you're up to your rear end in alligators? Mm-hmm. We're talking about big ideas and big planning, and the reality is it's a day-to-day battle with people of all different interests. You know, you heard a little bit with Secretary Clinton a little bit earlier on talking about is it ideology or what is it anymore? And I would tell you it's beyond that. It is just an emotional resistance to anything. It's an emotional resistance to change. It's an emotional resistance to staying where you are. And the real challenge that we have, aside from that political atmosphere which poisons Washington, which poisons Hartford, our state capital, and is poisoning the local council within Stamford. I don't know about Bridgeport or some of the towns in Long Island, but it is poisoning our ability to get anything done. Least say, talk about the longer term planning when all we can plan for is tomorrow. And secondly, I would tell you, and this is a huge disadvantage in my opinion for Connecticut, is that we have no regional planning. We are balkanized. It is the Stamford, it is Bridgeport, it is Westport, Fairfield, it's individual towns. And the reality is that if Stamford is going to be successful, and if the state's going to be successful, I need that Metro North train line to work from Grand Central and from Penn Station, not just to Stamford. I need it to work to Bridgeport and on to New Haven. And there are like four or five bridges that are going to cost $1 billion a piece that were built over 100 years ago. They all need to be replaced. And without somehow getting the whole region to recognize the collective goal, it isn't going to work if Stamford succeeds and Bridgeport fails. It isn't going to work if Bridgeport succeeds and Stamford fails. And we have no regional planning. We could talk about global warming. There is zero cooperative effort between Greenwich to Stamford to Darien to Norwalk to Westport as we go up the coastline in Connecticut. There is nothing happening that I can speak of. And there may be a great project in Bridgeport. Well, when the floods come, the water will just go around on either side and flood out Bridgeport. Just as anything that we do, the waters will come around the surrounding communities. I hate to be so negative, but we have a national issue about how does democracy move forward, and we have the ever-present issue of how do we plan more than a week advance? How can we think about 10, 20, or 30 years? Which is an enormous challenge for us, as I'm sure it is for most communities.
Lynn, before you get started, I just want to thank Melissa Mark-Viverito. She's got to run, but I really appreciate your being on this panel.
In Bridgeport, you know, as with every community, you struggle every day trying to do what you can and rely on the state and in the federal government. You know, so we keep doing what we do, but I think what's the way we can achieve our PA's vision is by partnering. And it's not just with the people in our communities like the anchor institutions, but it's with each other. And because we don't have regional government in Connecticut, it is that much more important that the towns, the cities work together, that the big cities do partner, because we have a stronger voice outside of our own towns at the state level when we do that. So that's how we have to make things happen now.
So I'm going to go to the audience for questions.
I'll be that guy. Thank you. I'd like to hear from the panelists your thoughts on how to overcome some of the myths that we all know about in terms of density and the impacts of density. I've worked with so many different communities on both the public side and the private side and trying to get growth happening. And there are so many fears about density and the others, all the kids that will come, all the traffic that will come. In your perspective, what have been the techniques that have worked the best? And I'm sorry that this, the former speaker had to leave, because her presentation on East Harlem Neighborhood Plan implied that there was a strong planning side up front. What were some of the messages that resonated with your communities that, that caused them to overcome those fears?
I'll start. One thing that we hear so often when any new housing development, you know, especially apartments, condos, that sort of thing, is proposed, is it's going to bring too many kids and it's going to crowd the schools. And we have a tax cap, so the school districts can't raise their levy by more than 2%, so they freak out. So what I tell them, I don't know how persuasive it is, but I keep trying, is that so often 1- and 2-bedroom apartments do not bring a lot of children. What happens is young people may move in, and then when they decide to have a family, they'll move to a house in the community. So it's just, it's not really going to add. There was out in Suffolk County, which is just to the east of us, there was in Patchogue, there's a huge development, lots of housing. I can't remember how many units, but hundreds of units of housing. And there was a major freak out about the amount of kids. It turned out it was basically a classroom size of kids spread K through 12. So those, that just doesn't happen. And I talk about the Patchogue example. We're working right now on in the hub, which is right in the center of the county where the Nassau Coliseum is, 77 acres of parking lot, wonderful opportunity for live, work, play, kind of mixed use. And there's 500 units that's zoned now. I'm actually thinking we could probably up that a little bit working with the town. But again, the school district there came to the meeting and said, we can't have it, it's too many kids. And I just try to, you know, gently explain and show examples in reality where that is not the case. And there are plenty of examples.
A different answer, and maybe you just caught me on a day I'm feeling a little bit down. I'm not certain that rational arguments are persuasive. I think that, you know, Stephen Colbert talked about truthiness a decade ago. It's turned into alternative facts, which is the nice way of saying they just make it up. We had a water crisis. Essentially, we had a record, you know, I think the worst drought that in Lower Fairfield County since the 60s and second worst in the last 100 years. And the one industry that has truly grown in Lower Fairfield County is irrigation companies. And the town of Greenwich next door to us was using so much water in their irrigation that even though they were half the size of the city of Stanford in population, they were actually using more water. They were watering their lawns all the time. We ran out of water. And so there were regional restrictions put on. And the anti-development group, the one that is concerned about explosive, unchecked growth, when in fact it's all checked, and explosive is about the rate of the population growth, was claiming, well, it's due to all that development. The reality is that the winter use of water has been declining as more conservation measures come in, and the new higher density apartment buildings have very low water use. Trying to present the truth of this is met with total derision and lack of understanding, and that extends to many other areas as well. It is just but one example. And you know, it's kind of hard to fight because, yeah, if you put in a new apartment, they do drink water, they do cook, they do have showers, but all of their stuff is water-saving technology, and the reality is that we're getting better on water, provided it's not irrigation, provided we're not in a drought. Our success has been where the situation was so dire that there really was no other choice. Our downtown 25 years ago was prime. Nobody wanted to live there. It was deserted at night, and it took a lot to turn it around. I could talk about that for another 15 minutes, but basically there were things that started turning around, and now people want to live there, and that was okay to a lot of people because they never envisioned living in the downtown. The South End, which is our other great development success, 10 years ago was brownfields and abandoned factories. And so there was not that resistance to that growth. But as this community has in fact improved its quality of life and more people want to live in the city of Stanford, there's been growing resistance, period. And I would tell you that You know, I call them the usual suspects. There's about 30 to 50 people that, you know, in various issues are the same people. They show up, they never believe, and they're always objecting. And sometimes they're pretty vociferous in their opposition. And it is a challenge, which is why, going back to earlier, I said it's almost like you have to have a catastrophe, you have to have a failure before you can move ahead, which is very disheartening to me.
Mr. Mayor, I'm sorry to say I agree with your view of the truth. Also being from
Connecticut. I wish we were wrong. Also being from Connecticut. I'm hoping we are.
So my question, to try to spin in a positive way, is what any of you see as successful ways to bring the other side of the other voices to, say, for instance, a local planning application approval for one of these developments. We only have the no's coming out, but all these people that are impacted by the lack of affordable housing, for instance, the businesses that are impacted by the workforce issues of retaining and attracting people, how do we figure out how to get them engaged so that there's a balancing voice?
You know, I think while the NIMBYs are very annoying, and it often is the usual suspects, and they overtake the narrative because they're the loudest, you know, there are examples where it does come from the grassroots. And where I live, there's a hamlet, an unincorporated part in a town called Baldwin. And the community actually they actually had a rally organized by David Viana here in the audience. Say hello. A rally for smart growth. There was going to be a CVS coming into this part, right, which is just ripe for transit-oriented development. Maybe, I don't know, a quarter of a mile from the train station, right on the main road, that was just sort of desolate and empty. And there was a CVS that was going to go there. And the people, you could say it's NIMBY. I actually think it's the right kind of NIMBY. They said, no, this, we want mixed use here. So sometimes it does happen when, you know, people want what is actually the thing that is the most sustainable and the best for economic development. So you have to find that and kind of encourage them. I often say, if we could make the people who want, maybe it sounds selfish, but who want what I want, but, you know, it's true economic development, job creation, mixed use, affordable housing, make them sort of as obnoxious and loud as the NIMBYs, then I think we'll have a fighting chance.
I don't take a direct role in zoning decisions, planning decisions. Yes, I obviously have an indirect role and I have a point of view about how we are doing things, but I don't try to take direct role. But what I am telling them is that, first of all, we can't be using zoning as a anti-competitive tool so that we freeze the ability for good grocery stores to come to town, for instance. That we cannot let a few loudmouths dominate the conversation and poison the atmosphere, and in fact reaching the point of a lack of civility. And there have been a couple of times where I've actually called up chairman of commissions and said, I want to thank you for standing up to the craziness. And whether or not they've got, you know, whether or not you agree with their arguments or not, I want to thank you for standing up for civility and for logic rather than craziness. And what was the last thing I was going to say? That's kind of what we're doing. We're encouraging that community to come out, but it tends to be the same very vocal and be angry and just irrational. And sometimes they have good points. I'm not saying they don't,
right.
But it's often irrational, and it dominates the discussion. And I would add that the local media can sell more papers by taking their quotes verbatim and sort of turning them into, you know, what clearly is not true begins to sound true because the paper is reporting it as if it were factual. It's a real challenge.
And Lynn, do you have anything to add from the planning perspective?
Well, I think I have a lot of I could say, but we don't have enough time. It's part of it is opening up the zoning process a little bit more and making it more transparent. I think that's really important in allowing everyone the opportunity to see what's actually being proposed, because a lot of times it's just the rumor mill that's out there about what's being proposed, and that gins up a whole lot of discord out in the community, and people come out and oppose something that really isn't happening. So somehow making that process more transparent is real important. And I think just having really solid plans in your community so that whatever development does happen, as long as it's in conformance with those solid plans, which the community has already reviewed and put their blessing on, then there shouldn't be as much opposition.
I was going to say to that point.
You already had your turn.
Yeah, I know. We are working on some plans in a particular area of our city. To that point, this idea of transparency, it is a battle. I don't think that we do all sorts of things for transparency, and then they still come out with their opinions, and the social media rumor is more powerful and faster, and the studies show that fake news travels faster than real news. It's a battle. But we are doing pretty much this thing. We are trying to find that community organization and start talking about, here are the realistic trade-offs. You want this, 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 and this, and you want to oppose that, 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 that. You understand that there's no way that you get what you want if you don't agree to some of the things that are necessary economically for these projects to work. And we are hopeful that we can make some progress. Part of the challenge is that that group that takes that much attention, that pays that much attention, is not the broad community. It is a much narrower group of people that either have an economic interest or some other interest that are paying attention to these projects and how they're going to plan out. But this sort of idea of, can we get them to begin to have a better appreciation of the trade-offs of, if we go higher, then we can pave more streets. If we do this, we can do that. What do you think? And I think we're making a little, you want a community center. Well, you can't get a community center for free. There's a cost for everything, and here are the trade-offs. And I think we're making progress, with the concern that we're talking not to the whole community, we're talking to a subset that is willing to spend the time to invest in that sort of dialogue.
So we've come to the end of this panel, and I'd like to thank each of the panelists for their contributions in talking about these flagship places in the fourth plan, and I'd like the audience to please give them a hand.